Hey team, it is Kelly, and this is day 3 of the Ishwish podcast. I'm so sad. I'm going through a little dopamine withdrawal, I think. I'm so sad that it's over. It was so amazing. Two things. It was an amazing combination of multidisciplinary care in work with a sex therapist, physical therapist, OB-GYNs, family medicine, urology. Amazing. And I think that's why, as far as like for people who have been to medical conferences before, like why it was so cool, because there wasn't this like hierarchy climbing of like just being internal medicine docs who are like, you know, vying for social hierarchy dominance things. It's like we're all here to learn, and it's clearly an exciting topic, and we just love that we're all here and that there are other people who care about the topic of sexual health in women. So that was so awesome. Number two, all of my Instagram like avatars, right? Like I got to the point where I'm like, you know, they're like, hey, I'm Jessica. And I'm like, what's your Instagram? Because like, I know people by their Instagram title. So like to see all the avatars come in and be like, oh my gosh, first of all, in your brain thinks these people like are famous because you see them on your phone all the time, right? And to realize like, no, they're just like us. And they actually have like real names and day jobs and they go to medical conferences, but we all have this like the way we communicate on social media now and the power of social media to connect us even before we come to a conference. So we're truly not showing up alone is incredibly cool. There is like not one mean person here. I mean, just the love. So incredibly cool. And then also kind of I wanted to speak out to the people who are like, why the hell did you guys have this conference in Texas? Multiple reasons. I think that the organizers actually really pained them that this conference was scheduled before Texas really cracked down on both trans rights for teenagers and for the availability of reproductive rights and freedoms for women. And that kind of flies in the face of like sexuality and education and medically accurate education and really the support of sexuality in all humans. So for people who had questioned, you know, and asked me like, what are my thoughts on that? To me, it's like, why not show up in a place that challenges this instead of a place that like is totally acceptive of it, right? Like why not show what's possible? Plus, you know, when you schedule medical conferences, it's often years in advance. So God bless. It was great. Dallas was kind. I actually got to go out last night and have an amazing dinner, really good dinner, and got some cream spinach, which I think is like a Southern Texas specialty. So it was fun to eat some local food, and it was super tasty. So God bless to Dallas. And it was really nice out last night. And I got to sit outside, which was super cool. So day three, this is day 3/4 because there was an hour and a half long talk today, which is technically day 4, but I'm not going to do a separate recording for it. So day 3/4 at the Ishwish conference. They first talked about looking at sexuality in women who'd had surgeries, pelvic surgeries. So either incontinence surgeries or prolapse surgeries. And what they found is women who have incontinence have more of a decreased libido issue than women with pelvic organ prolapse. But the avoidance of intercourse, so lower libido in women with incontinence versus prolapse, but more avoidance of sexual intercourse if you have prolapse versus if you have stress incontinence, right? And multiple reasons, right? Body image being one of them, fear that your bladder's going to leak is another reason. So what they found is that sexual function in women actually improves after surgery. So surgery in the pelvis always has a risk of sexual dysfunction, which is important in part of counseling and agreeing to have surgery for any pelvic issue. But what they've found across the board is sexuality and function actually improves after these surgeries way more than it is harmed by these surgeries, if you look at like rate of improvement versus risk of sexual dysfunction. And usually the reason for that is improvement in body image, right? So I'm feeling more confident about my pelvis. I'm feeling like my pelvis can function better. It's going to perform well. All the reason body image is one of the big reasons why sexuality improves after pelvic surgeries. So we always think about the risks, but we don't usually counsel women. I actually did this really well for like the first time. was a really healthy, fit woman. I think she was in her like early to mid 60s, sexually active, on hormones. Sexuality was important to her, and she had stage 3 prolapse. And there was just a study that was published looking at this type of woman, right? Sexually active, younger side, and should they do what improves sexuality better, using a pessary in physical therapy or surgery? And they found that in the surgery treated patients, their sexuality is improved more because you've actually fixed the problem. You're not just, you know, putting a band-aid on it with a pessary. No problem with pessaries and physical therapy, but for the sexually active woman, surgery tends to have a greater improvement in sexual function than management non-surgically with a pessary or physical therapy. So the other part of the study showed is that sexual well-being before surgery is a major predictor of your post-surgery sexual satisfaction. And I kind of tie this in with what we know about erectile dysfunction with prostate, radical prostatectomy, so prostate cancer surgery, is the better your erections are before your robotic prostatectomy for prostate cancer, the better they're going to be afterwards, right? So if you take somebody with poor sexual function and you do prostate surgery, it's really not going to be great afterwards. And they found that to be true in women. Their sexual well-being or views of their sexuality or how well they were functioning before the surgery was a major prediction of post-surgery satisfaction, which can, yeah, okay, that sounds intuitive and great, but like it's actually very good to know, right? Then we had a lecture about provoked vulvodynia. In 2015, they name changed this. So it was called vulvar vestibulitis. Prior to 2015, they changed it to provoked vulvodynia. They think 7 to 15% of women have provoked vulvodynia. And they said that there are psychological factors involved in provoked vulvodynia that can really make your pain worse. What we know is we sense pain in our brain. Right? Pain, we might say our pain is located in our vulva, but we sense it in our brain, and the role of what the brain does and how it functions in our perception of pain, we are literally like scratching the tip of the iceberg on our knowledge, right? So catastrophizing, not great for pain. And your level of catastrophizing at the beginning of the study predicted your pain scale or pain level 10 months into the future. So they knew the people who had worse pain, you know, prolonged or this chronic pain, had worse catastrophizing about it. And catastrophizing is like really making it like, oh my gosh, what is this going to do? What is it going to mean? My life's probably going to be wrecked. Like kind of these like thoughts that are very distressing. So catastrophizing, hypervigilance, so always checking, like, is it okay? How does it feel now? Can I do this? Kind of that awareness. And the amazing book that I just read, I haven't podcasted on it, it's called The Way Out, and it's basically the power of the brain on chronic pain. Talks a lot about that. If you want a good resource to talk to your pain therapist with, or your physical therapist, or your doctor on the power of the brain and mind work in pain. Also things that factor into provoked vestibulodynia is anxiety and then pain-related fear and avoidance. So so much of the conference is about body image and our self-view, and it's like, how do we compare, right, to the societal view of what a woman is and how sexuality should be experienced? It is such an important piece of our sexuality, and is our body and our view and how society and how we match up to what society says a woman is and how a woman should function and how a woman should behave sexually, all incredibly tied up into our sexual wellness. So the next study in the conference looked at Botox in endometriosis pain. So endometriosis is the uterine lining that is outside of the uterus, and it can cause inflammation and pain. And then the role of the pelvic floor muscles, right, in responding to pain, pelvic floor muscles can get really tight. Muscles get tight in a kind of protective defense against pain or threat of pain. Right? So pelvic floor muscles can be tight in somebody with endometriosis, either as a compensatory reaction or is there multiple things going on. So what the Botox did was it was Botox transvaginally. So they're not exactly targeting endo lesions. They just happen to be looking at women with endo. And they did Botox versus placebo. and they were looking at the women with chronic pain. So they said, even if you treat the endo, we still have about 30% of women with chronic pain, even though we can say like the endo lesions are gone, right? And is that pelvic floor or neuroplastic pain? I think there's still so much research to look into this. So there's good data now that Botox transvaginally into the pelvic floor helps with the pain in women with a history of endo. It's not FDA approved for injecting into your pelvic floor. Hopefully they're looking at it. Botox really is FDA approved for a lot of things. I use it in my practice with overactive bladder and urge incontinence, but certainly migraines and tight muscles, muscle contractures. So it is FDA approved for a lot of things, but it's not FDA approved for pelvic pain, pelvic floor muscle spasm, endometriosis, anything like that. And Botox is the only, there's another company coming out, but so Botox is the brand name of onabotulinum toxin, and it's quite expensive. So just buying the bottle of Botox is hundreds of dollars, plus the equipment you need, and then the doctor and the nurse and the clinic, all the expenses that add up to what a procedure costs, right? So if it's not FDA approved, that means insurance won't pay for it, right? So that's the hitch, is making a woman pay for this, right? And the other problem is this is not like a one-stop, I'm cured sort of thing. Botox wears off, our body processes it, right? So now you're looking at like every 6 months, which is fine if it's your bladder. Every 6 months, it's like as bad as going to the dentist twice a year for a checkup, right? Like I'm doing a Botox day this week, and I see dozens of women in 1 week. They're the happiest people. They wear their Botox socks. We catch up on what's happened since I saw them last. Like, it's fine. And it's not a huge expense for them because their insurance covers me doing Botox for their overactive bladder, right? But I don't do Botox for the pelvic floor because I just find that it is so cost prohibitive to have to keep injecting these women. So it certainly will be a huge advance in the pelvic pain world once Botox or its competitor can get FDA approval for these pain indications. But I think, you know, it's already is FDA approved for other pain, like migraines are pain, right? And tight muscles. So it's like, well, it's already approved in that department. Maybe hopefully it can be like an easy slide to the pelvis, but nothing's easy in the approval world. So the next talk, which was amazing, was by Dr. Marty Klein. I believe he's a PhD. He has been around for a long time. He's a very eloquent speaker and writer, and he talked about porn watching in couples. So it was heterosexual couples with the male being the porn watcher. We didn't even get into, well, what about when the woman's the porn watcher? Right. An amazing talk. He actually has the books on this and a website. So Marty Klein is absolutely amazing. And he just brings such an expansive view of it, is like the porn is not specifically the problem. It's what you're making the porn mean in the relationship. So it's always like how I talk about, like, people come in with low libido, but there's always something underneath low libido. Like, I'm exhausted, I'm stressed, my relationship strained, I'm, you know, hormonally a wreck and that needs to be adjusted. Whatever it might be, right? So what's underneath the problem with your partner watching porn, right? And he says the other thing that's missing in the discussion about porn watching is the male perspective, like his voice, right? Because usually it's like the woman identifies that the porn's the problem, the therapist agrees with the woman, and the man just needs to stop watching porn. And he's like, it's not helpful, and it's not a long-term solution, because we don't know his reason for being involved in this. And if he says, yeah, fine, okay, I'll stop, and then he restarts again, it's not the porn, it's the fact that he went against what he said and he broke a promise. So now that's an even bigger issue, right? So he talks, and talking about this, is we need his voice, we need his perspective. This is a couple problem, not just a man problem. And the question about like the sexuality of the couple and how that's affected with this. And also, he thinks a lot of everybody's problem with porn watching is not always, again, it's that layer that's underneath, not the problem with the porn, it's the problem with masturbation. And should one be masturbating outside of a you know, a couple partnered sex in a long-term relationship, right? And the fact that we're not talking about that, right? And is masturbation actually the problem? And our views about what we're making that mean. So it's super interesting just to listen to him talk about how incredibly complex that this discussion is. And it's, he says, just saying porn's bad, stop watching porn, you're not getting underneath, and he's a psychologist, so of course this is how his brain thinks, you're not getting to the underlying conversations that need to happen when this has been identified as something that is an issue in couples. It was a fantastic lecture. So I recommend, if you are interested in that or you know somebody who's affected by that, looking up Marty Klein and his books. So it basically is, porn is consumed in connection with masturbation. Right? People aren't just like, should I watch The Fast and the Furious or When Harry Met Sally or should I watch porn? It's like, I'm going to masturbate and porn's going to be part of it, right? So it has to be that ability to talk about that is important. And if you have an issue with masturbation, dealing with that first. So he said, well, why would somebody prefer masturbation with or without porn to partnered sex? Like, why would they want to do that? And he said, well, it might be more satisfying. There's no performance anxiety involved. You can control the experience. If there's ongoing conflict in the relationship, right, you don't have to deal with that in the moment. You don't have to have an agreement on things, or maybe the sexual routines have become boring. You don't have to stress about contraception or fertility or infertility. You don't have to deal with those struggles, right? So he's like, that as a way, a part of your sexuality can be looked at, why I might prefer that over partnered sex that has all these additional challenges. And he says, most couples will do anything to avoid needing to talk about their sex life, which I think should be recognized. It's incredibly difficult. As much as Marty Klein and I and everybody at this amazing conference can talk about it, for the average person, it's incredibly scary and challenging. And just acknowledging how difficult this is, we have not been trained to talk about it. But in a relationship that can be sexual in nature, we have to realize that communicating about this is an essential tool. So if somebody says, I want you to stop watching porn, is it actually a solution to what the underlying problem is, right? So what's the actual problem? Low sexual frequency in the couple, emotional distance, his untreated depression or anxiety, or constant chronic conflict of sexual routines, right? And her maybe feeling like, how come you get this outlet and I don't have an equivalent outlet, right? And like dealing with that. So it was amazing. That's all I'm going to say about porn. It was mind-blowing. And I just got hooked up with him, and I'm going to have him on my podcast at some point. He's phenomenal. He's been in this game for a long time. Okay, so then I gave my talk. So my talk was day three, and it was all about, it was with Dr. Jill Kraft and Dr. UC Ochai. I just call her UC. She's amazing. YOUSEE Logic is her Instagram. She's amazing. Her reels skills are incredible. So all three of us did a combo hour and a half talk on the role of social media and why healthcare providers in general should get involved, basically to counteract all the crap that goes on the internet and to help empower patients to take control of what's bothering them in their life, right? So I talked about the concept of our limiting beliefs and how, you know, our limiting beliefs kind of hold us back from living the life that we could lead. And once we identify our limiting beliefs, it really helps us. Talking about what came up a lot was the concept of the scarcity mindset, right? And I dealt with that too, of like, well, why should I have a podcast? Because X, Y, and Z already have amazing podcasts and there's no room for me, right? Instead of realizing like people need information presented in different ways to get it to land for the right person. Right? And, you know, changing, first of all, identifying your limiting, your scarcity mindset, and then turning it into an abundance mindset, right? As like an actual skill, right? I see when I'm having a scarcity mindset, I'm going to turn it into an abundance mindset, is actually a skill that can be learned. And I would argue it can help you anywhere in life. But the concept of, oh, there's 330 million Americans, let alone 7 billion humans, of which half of them are women, of which one third of them are perimenopausal, postmenopausal, like, holy crap, that is a huge amount of people, right? Just because two people who are doctors have a podcast, like, of course there's room for other people. And some people, like, you know, and UC was actually talking about this, like, if I'm not your cup of tea, I'm not your cup of tea, it's fine, like, unfollow me, it's totally fine. But to find out, like, I am some people's cup of tea, and they needed me to finally take the step, or to finally make it click, or to finally realize it was important, or whatever else. And so it's like, finding your voice will land for people. And if it doesn't land for some people, that's fine. There's other resources. So working on realizing when you have a scarcity mindset versus an abundance mindset is so cool. Somebody actually came up. So first of all, I made somebody cry. In a very kind, loving, I spoke to their soul way. So if you can give a talk about social media and make somebody cry, I think it's a pretty damn good talk. I give myself 4 stars out of 4 stars for how well we did on this talk. Lots of amazing feedback. Somebody actually said that our talk sounded like a coaching session. And I'm like, these people don't know that, like, I did this whole life coach school thing and, like, talk about limiting beliefs and scarcity mindset and blah, 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 blah. So, they picked up. They're like, this is kind of like a life coach session. And I was like, yeah, you picked up on it. Good job. Then we talked about, so moving on, next talk was talking about vulnerable and non-traditional populations. And one really great tip I took out of that, which I think applies to everybody who's doing this work, is ask about what the bedroom looks like, right? Like, if somebody's having sexual issues, it's like, what's your bedroom look like? And is it a mess? Is there shit everywhere? Does it, like, not help your brain focus on sleeping or sex? Only there's two things you should be doing in bed: sleeping or sex. You shouldn't be reading, you shouldn't be on social media, you shouldn't be watching TV, because the brain needs to know. It's a trigger for, this is where I sleep and this is where I have sex, and you don't do anything else in there. It just really helps the brain focus, like, this is the room for these two activities. And they've also noticed that in, like, treatment of insomnia and sleep issues, right? So both with sexuality and with sleep, keeping your bedroom a place just to do those two things. But asking about what somebody's bedroom is used for and what's in it. Somebody had, like, a big religious thing in their bedroom, and it was like, you know, God looking down on them, and they were having, like, spectatoring issues. I kind of giggled because I'm like, that person had a threesome without even, like, knowing or wanting to. But I just thought it was a really great tip for people. Then the next lecture was in the parenting transition, right? So pregnancy and postpartum, and how well, the research was how well are couples prepared for what the heck goes on after having a baby. And the data shows couples are not prepared. 81% report little to no info in pregnancy about sex postpartum. So people are not prepared about it. And then they think it's isolating. They think they're the only ones whose sex life got disrupted, when actually it's about 70% of people have their sex life disrupted after having a baby. So the other research said, if the couple received information about challenges postpartum, they had greater sexual wellness just by knowing about what was going on, which I thought was so cool. Parents have increased distress about their sexuality and decreased sexual satisfaction. They compared new parents to, you know, not new parents, right, as a control group. And by 6 months after having a baby, they were having the same amount of sex as people who hadn't had a baby. So numbers were there, but decreased satisfaction was still present, thus showing that quantity doesn't equal quality. And that there's still problems, even if you're having the quote, air quotes, normal amount of sex that people are having. So pain with intercourse after having a baby is 21% of women said they had moderate dyspareunia or pain with intercourse. And that's moderate is described as a 4 out of 10 on a pain scale. And by 3 months, it was still going on, but it was headed back towards baseline. Because remember, usually the only postpartum visit a woman gets is at 6 weeks, right? So certainly this continues until 3 months and then returns to baseline on average around 12 to 24 months postpartum for most people. So it takes weight. We have this myth of, like, bouncing back after having a baby, especially when we have a 6-week postpartum checkup, right, is like sexual distress and sexual dysfunction after having a baby is much longer than that. Oh yeah, 6 weeks, return to natural activities, you're going to be fine. So really good to know, and really good to support couples through that. The man needs to know just as much as the woman needs to know. Like his sense of, you know, our connection is different. Especially for men who have used sex as a way to connect and be intimate, right? And the challenges that can come across. And also the assumptions, right? We have so much assumptions about what that change in sexual frequency means. So the interpretation, what's underlying it. So as far as mode of delivery and sexual dysfunction postpartum, they did research and they looked at no difference in the delivery type, epidural, breastfeeding. So what their conclusion was, there was no biomedical trends to increase risk of sexual difficulties postpartum, which is really good to know. Right. That's really good to know. Protective factors. So like the people who had less sexual dysfunction after having a baby, what were their common protective factors? And in, you know, research speak, it's called common dyadic coping. What the hell is dyadic coping? Dyadic means two people. Finding solutions to their stress together. So being a team is actually protective against sexual dysfunction postpartum. And then again, risk factors. What are the risk factors for pain with sexual activity postpartum? This is the pain for the vulva owner, the vagina owner. Is pain catastrophizing, which was the most robust of all of these answers. Fear, hypervigilance, depression in pregnancy, and greater fatigue are all risk factors for pain, with pain catastrophizing being the most robust of all of those things. A great resource, which is what these researchers created this resource, is www.postbabyhankypanky.com, which is a pretty cute name. And just as far as, they've got videos, they've got written word, however you need to like to consume your content, it's a nice way to do it. So, and then the other thing to stress is this is an issue for the couple. It is not just the woman's problem. It's not just the man's problem. And again, heterosexual couples where somebody produced a baby from their body. But what would be very cool, and I have friends who had surrogates, right? So you take a surrogate. Has anybody done this research? Oh my God. You take a surrogate, then you bring a baby into the relationship. How is that sexual function or dysfunction in those couples the same or different from couples who had somebody produce a human from their body, right? And how much is it the introduction of the baby versus her physiologic changes that happen? Who's done this research? We need it. Please go do this research. I love thinking about research ideas. I do not like do it. Like I have a scarcity mindset and a limiting beliefs about me doing research. And I actually went out to dinner with this preeminent, amazing, beautiful human. His name's Dr. Andrew Goldstein. If you have vulvar issues anywhere and you're not getting answers and you have lichen sclerosis, go see him in clinic. Or Jill Kraft. It's Dr. Jill Kraft's partner. And we were talking last night about research and my limiting beliefs. And I actually have research that I have a question I want to explore more, and I think I kind of committed. I didn't even drink, you guys. I was not even drinking, and I think I committed to doing some research that I'm interested in clinically with both my online audience and with my patients. So, like, excuse me for swearing. God damn it, I was sober, and I agreed to research. That's how influential this guy is. He's a very big deal. He can convince me to do research. So, final talk of the Ishwish conference was called Mood, Menstrual Cycles, and Hormones. It was given by an OB-GYN, Dr. Tammy Rowan, and Dr. Nicole Serino, who's a physician at OHSU in Portland, Oregon. She is actually a reproductive psychiatrist, so deals with postpartum depression, issues with pregnancy, perimenopause, basically the role of like hormones and pregnancy and your psychologic mental health. Freaking amazing. So it was a cool talk. It was almost a standing ovation. So they talked first about premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. What it means is in the week before you have your period. So premenstrual dysphoric disorder. The symptoms are only in the week before your period, not in the weeks after or during. As soon as you get your period, these symptoms stop. Anxiety, depression, mood, lability, and creating conflict in your life. And what they think, the other parts of it, we reviewed the menstrual cycle, is your sexual desire peaks mid-cycle because that's your highest rate of testosterone when you cycle. And then progesterone likely inhibits desire through the menstrual cycle. I'm not talking about menopausal women. I'm talking about cycling, healthy ovarian function women. And allopregnanolone is FDA approved to treat postpartum depression. It's a GABA agonist. It's calming and it helps anxiety. And they said there's no role in checking a woman's hormones to diagnose or see if she has premenstrual dysphoric disorder. The other FDA-approved meds for PMDD are SSRIs, right? So looking at the role of dopamine and serotonin and increasing serotonin to help with this, the mood disorders. Oral contraceptive pills in general are not FDA-approved for this and are usually not helpful. But the gynecologist said that's what she sees mostly prescribed to women of like, oh, you're having this, let's just put you on birth control to flatten all your hormones. It's actually having to do with like the ovarian function that does it. But the drosferinone, I think, is the only one that has been shown to work. And it's because it's not like a air quotes real progesterone. It works. You guys, tangent, what if I start like saying air quotes in real life because I'm used to being on a podcast and need to tell you when I'm air quoting. But it works on other receptors besides just the progesterone receptor. So drosferinone is a quote-unquote oral contraceptive pill that can be effective. But there's limited evidence that oral contraceptives help. And certainly they see people given IUDs all the time because like the theory is like, oh, it happens right before your period. Let's stop your period. But the IUD just affects the uterus to not have a period. It doesn't work upstream with the cycling of the hormones and, you know, everything that's going on above the uterine lining. So they're like, IUDs don't work at all for PMDD. So this is like even for a urologist, this was fascinating because it involved like so many hormones and it kind of brought me back to med school, which was cool. So they said it's the withdrawal and then switching a little bit to perimenopause and that most women and even doctors don't know how roller coastery our hormones are in perimenopause. Perimenopause, again, 5 to 7-ish years before the official menopause, right? So this could be like a long time. It's the withdrawal from the estrogen that causes mood changes in perimenopause. And I actually stood up and asked a question at the conference at this talk at the end of it, as did a lot of people, because it just really sparked a lot of thoughts of like, I see a lot on social media and trending these influencers who are in the perimenopausal age, right? Like they're 45 to 51 and all of them are kind of really talking about like, I had undiagnosed ADHD. I had undiagnosed ADHD. And with my menopause lens, my NAMS certification lens, I look at them and I'm like, or are we just not treating your perimenopause? Right? And so that's what I was talking. I went into my question was, hey, I'm seeing all these influencers and I feel like it's really trendy right now to talk about your ADHD and how you need to get your ADHD treated and nobody ever picked up on the fact that you have ADHD. And is that actually either number one, just exacerbated by perimenopause or is it just perimenopause? Like you didn't have ADHD and now you have adult ADHD or adult onset ADHD. Is it just adult onset perimenopause, which can give you the same sort of like brain fog, lack of attention, you know, all these things that you know can kind of sometimes be generic. And I think it really struck a chord with the reproductive psychiatrist because she was like totally nodding her head. And she said like, they get like 3 to 4 women, perimenopausal women coming in at a time saying like, I have ADHD, I need it treated. And so she said, absolutely, this is a thing that's totally trending. Self-diagnosis is bringing people in. And that's not all bad, but she said ADHD is not something you can self-diagnose. It has actually strict criteria. And if we're just calling all perimenopause ADHD, we're treating the wrong thing. And then another urologist whose practice is on the, actually Dr. Rachel Rubin, who's passionately interested in this, says she has an ADHD group in her town that refers to her all the time because they realize the importance of hormone management in helping control these symptoms and helping control ADHD for the right person. Okay. I think this is the point where I say I'm a doctor, but I'm not your doctor. This is for educational and entertainment purposes only. But like, it's a thing. So I just, this is like the most kick-ass conference in the entire world. So you can give people a medication to suppress ovulation and then give them hormones because you need hormones when you're, especially if you're premenopausal, you need hormones. And that can actually work really well in premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So what else? Oh, perimenopause mood instability. Just going back to that, they think it's 40% of women. This is not like a super minority of people. Irritability, low mood, tearfulness, decreased energy, poor concentration. Sounds a lot like ADHD. Could be just perimenopause. So then the treatment's hormones, not ADHD medications. So go get evaluated by smart people who know the difference and are savvy. Because I think, you know, again, the research is showing perimenopausal depression. So I was not a depressed human until perimenopause, and now I'm depressed. Number one, that's a thing. But number two, hormones is the treatment, not an antidepressant. And so many women are being put on antidepressants instead of the actual treatment, which is hormones. That said, estrogen is not FDA approved for depression. But if your depression is associated with perimenopause and declining estrogen levels, it's a hormone problem, not a depression problem. So I hope that I'm as clear as I can possibly be about this very complicated problem. So clinical depression increases 2 to 3 fold, so 2 to 3 times during perimenopause and early postmenopause. 23% of women will experience depression at some point during perimenopause. Incredibly common. Again, perimenopause has no formal definition. It's just the time before menopause, definitely by late 40s. What we know, so say you're postmenopause, say you're 62 and you have depression, estrogen is not useful. So it's really those changing, our responsiveness to the changing estrogen, not I have no estrogen and I'm 70 and I'm depressed. They have studies. Estrogen does not help that kind of depression. Super good to know. And again, estrogen is not FDA approved to treat mood disorders. What we do know, and we have good evidence for, estrogen has been shown to enhance mood and well-being in non-depressed perimenopausal women. So you take a non-clinically depressed perimenopausal woman, you put her on estrogen or even birth control pills, and her mood is better, right? So we have that evidence. So if you've never had depression and then you get it in perimenopause instead of the antidepressants, especially I'm a, you know, sexual med doctor, right? Estrogen, if anything, is going to help your sex drive and sex life. And antidepressants are going to have sexual side effects, right? So again, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just giving you information to be educated about making the right decision. That if that sounds like a you or your sister or your friend thing of like, instead of considering an antidepressant for new onset depression symptoms in perimenopause, consider hormones instead. Because hormones actually have a whole host of other beneficial needs. So, oh my God, I just talked for 37 minutes about day 3/day 4 of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. I love you guys so much. I gotta check out. I'm 50 minutes post checking out of my hotel and I hope I don't get in trouble. Then I gotta go to the airport. I loved Dallas. Hi to all my Dallas people. Thanks so much for being wonderful hosts. I think you have a sex problem down here. I say, I went out to dinner last night and like and no judgment. Like, but what's interesting is the dichotomy or the duality, I think. So many people were dressed so sexually, which is different than how people are dressed in the Pacific Northwest. Mostly because I think we really want to be cozy. I think the Pacific North, here's a research thing. Do Pacific Northwesterners want to be cozy more than sexual? But the dichotomy of like how sexualized people were, and again, no judgment, but in a place that doesn't have sex education, if they give sexual education, it has to be abstinence-based. So you're dressing sexually, but then you're not supposed to have sex. It's all just very fascinating to me, and I've decided I'm more of a sexual philosopher than anything else at this point. So no judgment. I just love thinking how curious this damn state is. So I love you guys. I'll see you on the flip side. Thanks for letting me do my and supporting me in loving and telling me it's important for me to do my ish-wish day-by-day knowledge drop. So until I come back again, love you guys so much.